Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
After bagging the Taliban stronghold of Marja, General McChrystal turns his attention to the much bigger prize, Kandahar.
There won't be a D-Day that is climactic. It will be a rising tide of security as it comes.
D-Day, rising tides, but not a drop of water anywhere. The trouble with military metaphors in southern Afghanistan, they're about as catchy as military music. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, March 9th. The Takeaway virus takes down our dear Celeste Headlee, who's home today. Todd Zwillick joins me. And The Takeaway this morning is the real test of the surge in Afghanistan is going to be this campaign coming up in Kandahar. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, John. A much bigger campaign than they had in Marja. Well, let's get to some of the morning's top news. President Obama headed into a battle of his own yet again yesterday, but this one's on health care. During a stop in Philadelphia yesterday, he tried to stiffen the spine of wavering Democrats while sharpening his attack against Republicans.
I got all my Republican colleagues out there saying, well, no. We want to focus on things like cost. You had 10 years. What happened? What were you doing?
The president has asked that the House take a final vote on a Senate bill within the next 10 days. Back in Washington, there's a test vote in the Senate today that's important to anyone getting unemployment aid. Democrats need at least one Republican vote to move legislation extending unemployment insurance and several popular tax breaks, which expired last year.
In Afghanistan this morning, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says NATO and Afghan troops have seized the initiative, but hard days lie ahead.
Of course, the operation in Marja is only one of many battles to come in a much longer campaign focused on protecting the people of Afghanistan.
Secretary Gates is visiting Kandahar today, which could be the site of the next big battle. For more, we're joined now by Chris Morris in Kabul with our partner, the BBC. Chris, are there any decent metaphors for what's going on in Kandahar as coalition forces prepare for some kind of battle with the Taliban in the coming months?
Kandahar is the symbolic heartland of the Taliban. So by going into Taliban, McChrystal and other commanders here are sending the message, we're going to go after you right in the place where you believe you are strongest. The problem with that, of course, is that there will be casualties, foreign forces, probably civilians as well. I think that's inevitable. And Kandahar will possibly be the toughest moment of this expanded campaign over the next 12 to 18 months or so, when the aim of NATO is to clear a huge swathe of territory which has been Taliban controlled for a long time, and then quickly put in functioning civilian government behind it.
We talk more with Chris Morris, BBC correspondent in Kabul and a military analyst, about Afghanistan in just a few minutes. Todd?
Vice President Joe Biden is now meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Tel Aviv. He's there to try to kickstart preliminary peace talks. He'll meet with the Palestinian president tomorrow. And here at home, wedding bells will be ringing today for some gay couples here in Washington, D.C. Couples who applied for marriage licenses last week can pick them up today and tie the knot. So far, three weddings are planned at the city's Human Rights Campaign office. D.C. is the sixth place in the country permitting same-sex unions.
So, checking markets, Asian markets are mixed. European indices are down this morning. Futures on Wall Street are down. The Dow will get underway at 10,552. The S&P opens at 1,138. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,332. Coming up, more men are being laid off than women in the current recession. But more mothers are becoming the family breadwinner. We talk about work every Tuesday, and we're going to look at how this gender shift in the workplace is affecting work and family. That's later on in the hour. And our week-long series on genius continues today. You can catch up on our website, thetakeaway.org. We want to make today's question to you a little bit more personal. If you could be a genius at one thing, what would it be? And take a look at The Genius in All of Us, the book by David Shank, who's been co-authoring, co-curating our Genius series. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. Todd, you're a genius, right? Oh, don't laugh. His mother thinks so. Coming up, Afghanistan. Good morning, everyone. I'm here in New York. Todd Zwillick is joining me from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, John.
So the big news this morning really is, you might say, Defense Secretary Robert Gates is behind enemy lines in Kandahar, southern Afghanistan, the Taliban stronghold. He's there today along with General Stanley McChrystal. On Monday, McChrystal said allied forces have seen success finally in the former Taliban stronghold of Marja.
We have essentially got control of the area now.
McChrystal says the U.S. now has its sights set on Kandahar, Afghanistan's second largest city, and the one which makes Marja look something like a rural hamlet. Here's McChrystal again.
There won't be a D-Day that is climactic. It will be a rising tide of security as it comes.
And it's going to take some time to come. Both McChrystal and Gates in Kandahar are in anticipation of this much larger offensive in southern Afghanistan. And to get more on this, we went to Chris Morris, BBC correspondent in Kabul.
Yeah, this is something which we believe will happen later this year. It's always been the case that we started off with this Operation Mushtarak in and around Marja in Helmand province, but there is a broad swathe of territory in Helmand and then across the provincial border into Kandahar, where the Taliban have traditionally been in control. And it's that huge swathe of territory that NATO wants to take over and then get civilian government functioning. And one of the most symbolic places, probably the most symbolic place in that whole region, is the area in and around Kandahar city. I mean, there's a big NATO base in Kandahar, but the area around is very much the preserve of the Taliban. And that's something General McChrystal has identified as something he wants to change.
Now, I suspect this just completed campaign in Marja, one of its goals would have been to demonstrate to the Taliban that even on a small scale of territory in Helmand province, in Marja, that the Taliban can be removed. Is that message likely to go down well in Kandahar, to have any credibility in Kandahar, a much stronger stronghold of the Taliban, a much bigger place territorially?
That is one of the problems, is that whichever way you look at it, military operations, whether they're by foreign forces or Afghan, are not popular with local people. And you can understand it. It brings enormous disruption and danger. I was down in Marja a few days ago, and there were many, many complaints about military operations, even though NATO commanders insisted and some local elders agreed that troops had tried to be extremely careful about how they carried out those operations. It's a policy they're calling courageous restraint. Now, if you transfer those concerns from a relatively small place like Marja onto a big bustling city and surrounding districts like Kandahar, then those issues and those dangers will be magnified. So I think it's going to be a huge task. That's one of the reasons why Secretary Gates had said there are going to be some very tough days ahead, and it's way too soon to be talking about turning a corner in southern Afghanistan.
Well, then in your view, Chris Morris, is it starting from square one to go from Marja to Kandahar, or maybe a little bit ahead of that?
Well, you know, what's happening at the moment is that American troops, the surge, President Obama's surge, those troops are still arriving in country. We reckon about 6,000 have arrived at the moment. By the end of the summer, perhaps they'll be that's when the full 30,000 extra troops should have arrived. And many of those troops would be needed, I think, if there were to be a major operation about Kandahar, because it will be much bigger in scale and much bigger in the challenges it represents as well. And so I think Kandahar is probably the icing on the cake in terms of the way that McChrystal is planning this operation across these two provinces. But it's also clear that that's a place where there will be casualties. Already this year, American and British casualties and other NATO troops are far higher than they were at this time last year in terms of the number of people killed so far in the calendar year. And sadly, I think we do have to be prepared for the fact that that's going to continue throughout this summer. It's going to be a difficult summer with a lot of fighting. And the way they're doing the fighting means that NATO troops, foreign forces, will be taking casualties.
That was Chris Morris, BBC correspondent in Kabul. Let's bring in Colonel David Lam, who was the chief of staff in the Combined Forces Command in Afghanistan from 2004 to 2005. Colonel Lam, good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
You know, I want to give you the same question I gave to Chris Morris, and I don't know if he really answered it. Is the Marja offensive something that, while it ground out territory, and that's something they're going to have to do in Kandahar as well, ultimately the effectiveness of this entire surge is going to be convincing the Taliban that it's hopeless to resist? Do you think they made any headway on that in Marja?
Well, as the Secretary said, and I would probably add to his remarks, they have cleared militarily, and militarily they hold right now the town of Marja, a town of about 50,000 or so folks. The real test is whether the Afghan government can roll in behind and with the police and with the Afghan army and police, they can now hold and, in fact, bring good governance to Marja. That would be the key. The key is...
So let me just hold you up there. So if there's good governance in Marja, the people in Kandahar will get that message, and all of a sudden that changes the military equation for the troops going forward in the next couple of months.
Well, perhaps, but as was pointed out earlier in the spot here, Kandahar is a completely separate and to draw lessons learned about Marja to Kandahar. Marja's 50,000 folks, rather small hamlet, as was pointed out. Kandahar is a major city of 850,000 people, and it is in fact the holiest of places. It is really the spiritual heart of the Taliban inside Afghanistan.
Can the government project itself as being a custodian of the holy lands of Afghanistan, or is that something that the Taliban owns at this point?
Well, it can over time, but I would say at the present time, the Taliban owns that mantra and has owned it since 1994,
right.
When Mullah Omar, in fact, the holiest site inside Kandahar is in fact a mosque which contains a cloak of the Prophet Muhammad. Last seen in 1994 when Mullah Omar actually put it on, a brilliant propaganda move that really wedded the Taliban as the religious keeper inside of Afghanistan.
Well, so again, it's a significant move that Secretary Gates is actually in Kandahar at this moment, setting up for what could be a reversal for the Taliban. But we'll have to see. We might get started for several months at least. Colonel David Lamb, thanks so much. Chief of Staff, former Chief of Staff, Combined Forces Command in Afghanistan from 2004 to 2005. Talking about next steps in Afghanistan. Thank you, Colonel.
You're welcome.
So 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following. Todd?
President Obama, John, turned up the volume on health care yesterday at a rally near Philadelphia. He set up the insurance companies as his main target.
How much higher do premiums have to rise until we do something about it? How many more Americans have to lose their health insurance? How many more businesses have to drop coverage?
And the president also criticized Republicans for holding up reform, but Republicans in the Senate and the House still insist Americans want reform plans scrapped and rewritten. Today, meanwhile, President Obama meets with Greece's prime minister to talk about that country's faltering economy. Greece is urging the federal government to increase regulation of hedge funds. Athens says speculators have deepened the country's troubles.
That's having ripples all over the financial world. Also this, Nigerian troops out in force after the killing of hundreds of people in ethnic violence there. The area is affected by a hotbed of ethnic strife between Christians and Muslims. Toyota has again said its sudden acceleration problems are not electronic. A spokesman, Mike Michaels, says investigations show the problem is mechanical in nature.
We have found no evidence, and engineers are trained to look for evidence. And we have found no sign that electronics have anything to do with unintended acceleration.
Finally, here at home, another record for the UConn Huskies. The women's basketball team carved itself another spot in the record books. They beat Notre Dame last night 59-44, 71st straight win, the NCAA record. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, the healthcare battle wages in the shower. A little more about Congressman Eric Massa in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
So our first takeout is probably not the biggest story down in Washington. It's not a tanker contract or a jobs bill, but the shrill voice of former Congressman Eric Massa is certainly dominating the coverage of the health care reform bill, at least for the next couple of days. Todd Zwillick, who's co-hosting with me, always in Washington, joins me. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, John.
Set this in some sort of context. Massa has a real beef with the Obama administration. First of all, what's he saying about his vote? And then I have a piece of tape that I want to play you.
Yeah, so to set the scene here, I think I need my top hat and my whip. No, that's center stage. I need to somehow get to the sideshow because that's what Eric Massa has become. He's a freshman congressman from Western New York, John. Announced last week that he wasn't running for re-election because of a cancer diagnosis, and from there, everything just sort of unraveled. To get to the bottom line, Massa voted no on the health care bill some months ago. He's a Democrat now, and he voted against the administration on health care. He also voted against the administration on cap and trade, another marquee domestic agenda item for the president. And now that Massa is leaving under a cloud of potential sexual harassment allegations and everything else, he's now saying that he has been forced out by the Democratic leadership.
He's shouting on his radio show saying, they will stop at nothing to get this bill passed, and now they got rid of me, and it will pass. You connect the dots. And then he added this little bit of, I don't know, what would we call this, color, narrative. You just listen.
And I'm sitting there showering, naked as a jaybird, and here comes Rahm Emanuel, not even with a towel wrapped around his tush, poking his finger in my chest, yelling at me because I wasn't going to vote for the president's budget. Do you know how awkward it is to have a political argument with a naked man? It's ridiculous. But that's... So, by the way, what the heck is he doing in the congressional gym? He goes there to intimidate members of Congress.
Now, first of all, does the White House have a comment on this comment? And I guess this guy, Eric Massa, has a future on the Glenn Beck Show.
Yeah, he does have a future on the Glenn Beck Show. In fact, that future may be realized by 5 o'clock this afternoon, John Hockenberry, because Eric Massa is going on Glenn Beck this afternoon, which seems like the perfect venue for the argument he has with the White House and the Democratic leadership now. And he's going on Larry King by tonight. There's a lot of other stuff, and a lot of this comes from Eric Massa's own radio show that he does up in his former district in Western New York. So that was his last broadcast as a congressman on Sunday. You can go online and hear it all. Some of it's even better. Some of it's even better than that.
Now, you know, there are many stories of Rahm Emanuel being intimidating. I'm not prepared to confirm or deny this one. But does Eric Massa, all self-interest aside and, you know, his ambitions to maybe have his own cable show, all that aside, does he have a point here?
A point, you know, Rahm Emanuel is famous for intimidating members of Congress, but I think we have to take his accusations and his concerns about Rahm and the White House perhaps with a grain of salt, and here's why. The one thing we haven't talked about is that the Ethics Committee was investigating Eric Massa for an alleged sexual harassment charge against a member of his own staff, which Massa refutes and says a third party was actually concerned about it. The staffer in question wasn't even concerned, and he goes into that in detail on his radio show in language about as interesting as we just heard. So I can't say what his motivation is, but Sideshow, I think, John, accurately reflects what this whole thing has turned into.
Although the main show is they're definitely counting the votes there at the White House. Okay, I'll grant you this isn't the most important story in Washington. What is right now before we go?
Well, jobs is a huge story. And in a way, this is related to the most important story in Washington, John, because Nancy Pelosi now needs 216 votes with Eric Massa out. So in a way, it is tied into health care. That's the big story, collecting votes for health care.
Healthcare and jobs and all of these important components of the administration's agenda, which come down to votes in the House at this point. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent and co-hosting this morning. Thanks so much for that.
Sure thing.
Stay tuned. Your mother thinks you're a genius, right, Todd?
Oh, absolutely.
Of course she does. Our last takeout, we turn the microphone over to our listeners who we've always thought of as geniuses. And we're not surprised to learn at all that they had plenty to say about our week-long series exploring genius, what it is, who is one, what are the qualities of geniuses. We're talking about the book The Genius in All of Us by David Shank, which suggests that genius is maybe less of a mystery than we've always been led to believe. And later on in the hour, we're going to hear the story of one genius, violinist Sarah Chang. But we got the conversation started yesterday by talking about this myth of genius. What is a genius?
Troy from North Dakota. By my definition, a genius is a visionary thinker. But the visionaries I've known have been big ego elitists whom nobody wanted to work with.
Sounds like Troy thinks that a genius is more like a jerk.
Yeah, he had some bad experiences with geniuses.
He may have, although not all geniuses have to have that huge ego Troy's talking about.
My name is David Young. I'm from Miami, Florida, and genius in my life is Dr. David Ellenson. He was one of my teachers at Hebrew Union College, but what really makes him a genius is that whenever he walks up to me and says hello, he not only remembers my name, and he teaches hundreds of people on a daily basis, he remembers my name, my wife's name, my children's names, and about how old each of them are. And that's really what makes him a true genius, is his caring for the person.
Well, there's also the kind of genius, John, that can do astounding things just in the everyday.
My name is Rose Carvajal. I want to say that my brother is definitely a genius. Since a little boy, he has done unbelievable things. Today, he's in his 60s, and this man can pick up anything, read it, and know it backwards and forwards.
Oh, that's so great. You know, I went to math. I studied math at the University of Chicago, majored in math. There were all kinds of geniuses in that department, and I was definitely not one of them. Gina in Miami posts to our site, genius is actually the interaction between a person's soft assets, creativity, passions, and values, with their hard assets, skills, expertise, and strengths. Sounds like Gina should write her own book. What's your take? You can weigh in and catch up on our site, thetakeaway.org. While you're there, you can read an excerpt from David Shank's book. David will be answering your questions on genius all week at thetakeaway.org. And later this morning, we talk with one genius, violinist Sarah Chang. Yeah. Can you do that? Yeah. When you're 9 years old? Yeah. Uh-huh. That's Sarah Chang in one of her first recordings. Later on this morning, we're going to talk to her. And also, if she believes she's a genius, and if she doesn't, what does that mean? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tell us at thetakeaway.org.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for Celeste this morning. Coming up, the FBI's most wanted list turns 60 years old this month. We talk about how it's evolving for this decade by using social media. More on that in just a few minutes. Now, here are some of the top news stories we're following at 31 minutes past the hour. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is visiting the Taliban heartland today. He's in Kandahar, a city of nearly a million people that's expected to be the target of the next big NATO offensive. This morning, Gates restated the U.S. position on preventing civilian casualties.
When, despite our very best efforts, they do occur, we will continue to acknowledge our mistakes and find new and better ways to coordinate more closely with Afghan forces.
Earlier today, Secretary Gates visited a small remote outpost near Kandahar where a U.S. Army unit has lost 22 men and suffered an additional 62 wounded since the summer, John.
Here in the U.S., the Supreme Court has agreed to decide whether the father of a Marine killed in Iraq may sue protesters who picketed his son's funeral. A Kansas-based church group showed up with signs that read, "God hates you," and "Thank God for dead soldiers," because of what they call the military's passive stance on homosexuality. A federal appeals court dismissed the suit on First Amendment grounds. Senate Democrats need at least one Republican to vote with them today on a test vote that could extend jobless benefits. The bill also contains about 60 popular tax breaks that expired at the end of the year. End of last year. The percentage of American workers with virtually no retirement savings is up for the third straight year. 43% have less than $10,000 in savings, up from 39% last year. The survey also found that American workers who have less than $1,000 saved jumped from 20% in 2009 to 27% now. Let's check the markets. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are down. Futures are slumping at this hour. The Dow gets underway at 10,552. The S&P is going to open at 1,138. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,332. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
In the last weeks of March 1931, Elliot Ness and his Untouchables were hitting hard at the Capone Empire. Every day, gunshots rattle the concrete as Ness led his men in raid after raid.
It evokes the days of G-Men and J. Edgar Hoover and the old days of Tommy guns, right? Gangsters and the FBI. Well, the FBI's 10 most wanted list actually came into existence in 1950. Now, that's 60 years old today. On March 14th, 1950, a guy named Thomas Holden became the very first man to be put on the top 10 list. He earned the distinction as a noted bank robber and train robber who killed his wife and her two brothers. Now, a little over a year later, Holden was arrested when a man reported his whereabouts after seeing his picture picture on a most wanted poster. Well, are most wanted posters a thing of the past? Because now we have most wanted apps, believe it or not, for that iPhone or your handheld, your handhold PDA. The list has become something of a hyping tool, and the FBI is swerving into the digital era. FBI historian John Fox is here to tell us about how the list has been working since that successful start way back in 1950. Dr. Fox, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. So give us something on the numbers here. How many people have been on the FBI's most wanted list, and how many people have been captured?
Well, we've had over 490, I believe it's about 494 people on the list since it was started. And of those, 463 have either been captured or located. You know, sometimes someone's taken off the list because of court action or things like that.
So that's a hit rate. I'm not great at math like John Hockenberry is, but that's a hit rate of over 90%.
It is a very good hit rate, yes. And about a third of those have been because of citizen participation, which, of course, is the purpose of the list.
So with most wanted posters, you know, they're not on the post office wall anymore, as, you know, communities used to. The post office was the center of life, and they're not so much anymore. How is the top 10 list working now? Just television advertisements, billboards? How's the FBI getting the list out to people these days?
Well, really through a wide range of media, from TV shows like America's Most Wanted to, of course, the internet to digital billboards. We have a number of those digital billboards around the country that will post fugitive information
off the side of highways. You're talking about?
Yes, sir.
You know, Dr. Fox, you know, that 90% success rate, it reminds me that J. Edgar Hoover was a fabulous self-promoter there in Washington, as you well know, down through history. Is it possible the 10 most wanted list is actually the 10 most nearly caught list?
Well, considering that some of these people have been on the list for a very long time, and certainly over history, the average rate is not a matter of days, but often a matter of months. No. Some of them have been captured even before we could get the publicity out. There's a small handful of them, but most of them, the publicity got out, and it was often a help. As I said, about a third of our captures have been because of citizen tips.
And John Fox, what is the longest amount of time a fugitive has spent on the 10 most wanted list?
I don't have that at the tip of my tongue, but it is, about 20 years.
Wow. Oh, yeah. 20 years on the run. Well, the whole idea of the FBI having the list is to keep fugitives from being on the run for 20 years. And I want to turn now to Ken Hoffman. He's the unit chief over the investigative publicity unit at the FBI. Mr. Hoffman, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, the FBI, as I said earlier, is moving away from the post office poster and swerving into social media. Describe for me exactly the new 10 most wanted list. What does it look like?
Well, since about 1996, we've posted all of our information about the 10 most wanted on our website. That was done mostly to increase visibility, and it really takes our 10 most wanted list beyond the borders of the United States. It used to be if you wanted to know who was on the list, you had to stop at a post office. That's not the case anymore. You can just log right on onto our website. In addition to that, we've moved more into social media using tools like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube.
Well, Ken, I'm wondering, it is one of the first sort of calls for crowdsourcing, and it goes way back to the 90s, as you say. But I'm wondering if you want to enlarge it. I mean, if I had an app on my iPhone, I think I'd be much more interested in a, 10,000 most wanted list and be able to see who's moving where from time to time. And I'd be much more interested in that than just 10. Maybe you want to enlarge it, 1,000, maybe 100.
Well, on our website and through our other investigative publicity means, using social networking, we do provide information about other fugitives and missing persons and missing children and unknown victims. But the thing about the 10 Most Wanted program is it's very focused, and our purpose there is to focus people on the people that we think are the fugitives that we think are the biggest menace to society, the people with the longest records of criminal activity, and the people that we really think that the publicity is going to do some good to try to find them.
Now, Ken Hoffman, how many times to date have you nailed a fugitive and the tipster called in and said, "I saw him on Twitter"?
Well, I can't say we've had anyone yet. But
right.
I will say that we do have 33,000 followers on Twitter right
really?
Now.
Really? 33,000? More than I have.
That's only, we've only had Twitter running in the FBI here for probably the last 12 or 14 months.
You also have tie-ins with digital billboards and jumbotrons at ball games. So the idea is flash up a fugitive's picture down at the baseball game, and you might see him on the way home.
That's correct. We'll put him where we have the most set of eyes. You know, I like to talk about one of our most successful billboard captures, and that's actually we had a mother who was driving down the highway and saw her son on a billboard, and she turned to her son in the passenger seat and said, "Why is your face up on that billboard?"
And he said,
"The dog ate my homework."
Right, and she pulled over and called the FBI. Well, that's crowdsourcing at its very finest, family sourcing.
That's
Ken Hoffman. Ken Hoffman is unit chief over the investigative policy unit at the FBI, joining us to talk about the new look of the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list, John,
which is 60 years old this month. You can see a slideshow of some of the FBI's most historic wanted criminals at thetakeaway.org. And coming up, our work segment, we're talking about the gender change in the workforce in this recession. More mommies, the family breadwinner. So one of my favorite places in the universe is the Florida Everglades, where it is fair to say that almost anything in the biosphere will grow, will thrive, except for humans, unless you drain it. Tony Young, good morning.
Good morning.
You're the statewide hunting expert in Florida, media relations coordinator for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Good morning to you.
That is correct. Good morning. It's early.
It is early, but not too early in the Everglades, where there are things creeping and peeping and moving around, and even at this hour, right?
That's right, always.
Is it the case that you drop something into the Everglades, except for maybe a human being, and it's going to thrive?
Well, it's just, you know, that part of the United States is very subtropical. I mean, it's really probably the only subtropical area in the United States. So there is a lot of different things that can live down there that can't live in other parts of the United States on a year-long basis.
And lots of sun, lots of fresh water, and lots of vegetation. It's basically paradise for pythons, right?
Well, yes. It has been. They've become established down there, and we think we've kind of traced it back to Hurricane Andrew. When Hurricane Andrew hit back, Miami was, and it still is, has a large number of exotic pet dealers. And basically, we think when the hurricane came and destroyed some of these businesses, the pythons were able to get out of their cages, and they made their way west to the Everglades.
So now there are enough pythons in the Everglades to justify a hunting season, which is open now, right?
Yes, sir. It's actually we have been allowing hunters to actually harvest pythons and other reptiles of concern actually since the beginning of hunting season in late August. So it's been going on all year, but right now there's a special reptile of concern season going on because nothing else is being hunted right now in these three management areas down in South Florida except for the Burmese python. So that did start yesterday, and it will go through April 17th.
And it is a huge problem. I mean, you know, we don't want to joke about killing animals for no reason, but the population of pythons puts a stress on other species, much like invasive fish species have caused problems down in the Everglades. What would you recommend hunting a Burmese python with? A bow, a gun, a net?
Well, we are allowing hunters to use any weapon that you would that you could use on a game animal, except for high-powered centerfire rifles. So you can't use the 30-30 or 30-06 or 270 or something like that. But basically, I would recommend a 12-gauge shotgun with buckshot.
Oh, now, you know, I'm going to get so many calls and emails and stuff about people worrying about the poor little snakes. Now, you mentioned harvesting the snakes. Do people actually eat python or do something with python other than put it in the landfill?
You can. I mean, you can eat python just like a lot of people eat rattlesnake, but. We did do some testing on some pythons earlier, I guess, in the year, or I guess actually last year, And it revealed, the testing revealed some pretty high levels of mercury content in the meat. So we're really not recommending anybody eat the meat. But
well, it's open season now. Burmese python hunting season in the Florida Everglades, a way of dealing with the population explosion of pythons. Tony Young is a statewide hunting expert and media relations coordinator for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Thanks, Tony.
You're welcome.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Todd Zwillick, who's in for Celeste Headlee. Coming up, more men being laid off than women in this current recession. You've heard that statistic before, but is it causing some underlying changes in the workplace and in the home life for families who are disrupted as more women become the family breadwinner? We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at coming up to 48 minutes after the hour.
Thanks, John. President Obama made an impassioned plea for his health care reform bill yesterday, speaking to students near Philadelphia. He said insurance companies would be delighted by more delays because they'll just keep jacking up their premiums.
There's no secret they're telling their investors this. We are in the money. We are going to keep on making big profits, even though a lot of folks are going to be put under hardship.
Now, the president's health care reform bill sends hundreds of billions of dollars in subsidies to those same insurance companies. Republicans say the president's plans are too costly. Brazil, meanwhile, has issued a list of 100 American products that will face heavy tariffs unless the U.S. agrees to stop paying subsidies to cotton farmers. The sanctions, which will go into effect in 30 days, have been approved by the WTO. That's the World Trade Organization. BBC business correspondent Duncan Bartlett joins us with more. Now, Duncan, good morning.
Good morning. Well, this is a real trade war because what the Brazilians are saying are, first of all, that they're going to put a huge tax or tariff on any cotton or cotton goods coming in from the United States into Brazil. You can understand why they might feel angry about that because they are not happy with the subsidies given to the cotton farmers. But they're going much further than that. They're saying they will also put a tariff on things like cars, on even things like milk powder, and they're even saying that they might try to penalise the pharmaceutical or the music industries from the United States by breaking copyright and intellectual patent agreements on those things, which would mean that they're penalising as many different companies as they possibly can in an attempt to stop the American government subsidising U.S. cotton farmers.
Is this a bona fide trade war at this point or something that'll blow over in a couple of weeks?
It's endorsed by the World Trade Organization, which acts as a sort of judge and policeman on these kind of international disputes, and it's very clearly on the side of Brazil. Now, what the Brazilians are saying is that this should have been resolved, and the Americans should have stopped these subsidies to the cotton farmers a long time ago. And the World Trade Organization says, OK, in that case, you have the right to escalate the dispute by bringing in all these other products. Now, what the Americans would really like is a new bill to pass through Congress in the United States saying no more subsidies to American cotton farmers. That's obviously very, very unlikely to happen because the administration in the US is just too aware that the political implications of that and the unpopularity that it would cause with the farming communities, particularly in the south of the United States, is just not worth the price.
Right, and all that posturing just could lead to a trade war. Duncan Bartlett with our partner, the BBC. Thanks.
He has a pretty astute understanding of the farm vote there in the south, don't you think there, Todd?
Yeah, he sure does.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Overseas, Vice President Joe Biden is in Israel today to try and jumpstart the Middle East peace process. He says the U.S. will stand by those who, quote, take risks for peace.
I think that the interest of both the Palestinians and the Israeli people, if everyone will just step back and take a deep breath, are actually very much more in line than they are in opposition.
The vice president will meet with Israeli and Palestinian leaders today and tomorrow. Finally, one of the two Baptist missionaries accused of kidnapping in Haiti is back in the United States. Charissa Coulter was freed by a judge who is also expected to release the remaining missionary, Laura Silsby, the group's leader. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Well, with weeks and weeks and weeks of recession and climbing job numbers under our belt, the work week is much more about a shift that's taking place in the United States. Since December 2007, we have lost 7 million jobs in our country. That's not an unfamiliar figure. But the majority of those who've lost those jobs have been men. At the same time, Women have been returning to the workplace in higher numbers than their male counterparts. So more and more women have taken on the role of primary breadwinner for their families. It has an impact at home and an impact on the job. Joining us now is Ellen Galinsky, president and co-founder of the Families and Work Institute. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning.
And Yolanda Gold-Cavaness is a longtime family and parenting journalist for iVillage and Redbook. She's also here. Good morning, Yolanda.
Hi, how are you?
Now, I'm great. And, you know, they've been calling this the man session, or I don't know what sort of clever term they've been using for quite a while. But with these kinds of numbers, Ellen Galinsky, let's just begin with you. There's some sociology going on here. Are we really seeing a shift that has an impact in the workplace and in homes?
Well, interestingly enough, the majority of the job loss in the beginning was among men, but now it's kind of evened out so that it's 41% of women who have lost jobs if you take last February to this February,
right,
and up 59% of men. But these shifts actually were happening before the recession. We have been tracking the U.S. workforce with a national study that we do for three decades, and we have seen a real change in both women and men. We've seen that the attitudes about women and men, about the proper roles of taking care of the family and working, have shifted, where that for the first time women and men agree. We see that young women are just as ambitious as young men, and women with children are just as ambitious as children as women without children. And we also see that now women are bringing in 44% of family income, and that one in four women is earning more than her husband or her partner.
And
so
there's
a real shift going on, but it's been taking place before the recession.
And socially, those things are going to ripple for many years to come. Yolanda Gold-Cavaness, let's talk a little bit about from the employer's perspective here. Are employers seeing young women coming into the workforce at this point as the men are sort of moving out in greater numbers? And are they enthusiastic about these ambitious young women hires?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that young women have been coming into the workforce for a while now. And, I mean, I just wanted to say, even though, you know, we are talking about women being the primary breadwinners, I'm sure Ellen would agree, let's not get it twisted. You know, the wages that women earn are still lagging far behind the wages that men have earned. So,
well, but
does
that explain the enthusiasm in that employers are going, well, we can get these women for cheap?
Well, it certainly might. I don't think that's something that we can ignore. And I think, you know, when I talk to women around the country, working women, and it doesn't really matter if they have children or don't have children, but, you know, if they don't have children and they're thinking about having children, it certainly does affect them. You know, that's the whole childcare situation. It's still, you know, it's a difficult road to toe.
Right. Ellen Galinsky, with so many two-income households, I'm imagining that there are a lot of women on the job who haven't lost their jobs, who have spouses or partners who have lost their jobs. Does that require changes on the part of employers in looking at the flexibility and the need for this suddenly single-income household to cope?
Well, there has been a real shift among employers around flexibility. It used to be seen as a perk, something that you would do under the table for a good employee, but you certainly didn't want a lot of people knowing about it, because who would be there if you need them to work, et cetera. In this recession, and we actually did a study, a nationally representative study of employers, we found that 81% of them, that's four in five of them, were maintaining the flexibility that they had as a result of the recession, and 13% were increasing it, and only 6% were cutting it back. And that represents the fact that employers are now seeing that they can help employees at the same time that they can help employers. Now, taking Yolanda's point, we looked at whether or not people, this flexibility was voluntary or not, or were they just furloughing people. And a little bit more than half of employees have choices about working more flexibly. We define flexibility as needing to work for the employer and the employee. So some of the flexibility that's happening is really to just manage. But I think employees, on the other hand, would rather have a job than no job. So
indeed. Well, Ellen Galinsky, of course, president and co-founder of the Families and Work Institute, speaking from New York. Yolanda, before we go, final question. Is it possible that with all the caveats you've mentioned, that this recession is really bringing on a degree of progressivity in the workplace and in gender relationships at home between men and women that we might not have seen otherwise?
I say a decade ago, you talk to women around the country, the theme song would have probably been the Rolling Stones, "I Can't Get No Satisfaction." It's slowly improving. I think that when you talk to women now, they know that you have to negotiate with your employer, and they feel confident doing that. They need to go negotiate with their partners at home, and they need to let go of the perfection complex that many of them have. Myself, I tell myself every day, I am not Claire Huxtable. It works for me.
All right, well, you and me, we're going to have to look for a new song to replace "I Don't Get No Satisfaction." Yolanda Gold Cavernous, a longtime family and parenting journalist whose work has appeared in iVillage and Redbook. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So we're talking about genius on The Takeaway. If you have anything to add to our conversation on genius, you know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.